Hi, this is Todd Haymore, Secretary of Agriculture and Forestry for the Commonwealth of Virginia. I listen to Heritage Radio Network.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Today's episode of Straight No Chaser has been brought to you by Fairway Market. For more, visit FairwayMarket.com.
Good morning. This is Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I am speaking to you from the studios of the network in the back of Roberta's at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Brunch is being served. My guests today are Stacy Miller, the Executive Director of the Farmers Market Coalition, and Michael Hurwitz, who is the Executive Director of Green Market New York City, and coincidentally, a board member of the Farmers Market Coalition. Welcome to both of you. You're there, right?
Yes.
Hi, Katie. Yes.
Hi.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Stacy. Thanks so much for joining me. I can't hear myself. Thank you. There, that's better. So, guys, we had a couple of... first of all, Stacy, why don't you talk a little bit about the Farmers Market Coalition? Because you're sort of like an information clearinghouse for anybody who wants to start a farmers market, right?
Yes, in many ways. The Farmers Market Coalition is a national 501c3 or a nonprofit founded in 2006 with a mission to strengthen farmers markets for the benefit of farmers, consumers, and communities. And that three-prong... triple bottom line, I guess as we call it, is really integrated into everything we do. So we focus our efforts on education, networking, and advocacy. Our members are farmers market organizations, farmers, state farmers market associations, and as well the nonprofits, businesses, and individuals that want to see farmers markets thrive.
Fabulous. It's a good thing you're out there. And Michael, you're a board member of the Michael Coalition. No, Michael, you're a board member of the Coalition. Sorry about that, you guys. So you help them, you help advise them on how to make that happen, that kind of stuff?
I am one of many who sit on the board, my colleagues from around the country, mm-hmm. All who are doing incredible work. Yeah, really bringing our experience and understanding and expertise to the organization. Some bring connections, some bring their experiences, and it really is a. You know, I go onto the website all the time to look for resources. Some of the advocacy positions that the FMC has been able to take, I'm not able to take at Green Market on the national level. Stacy does an incredible job educating. Our federal legislators on a number of issues that are relevant to us. So, yeah, it's a privilege to be a member.
That's groovy. You guys, both of us, we all three of us read the article in the Times on Wednesday in the food section. I'm going to totally change the subject here. And speaking to the issue is a Gina Colada article about how there is no correlation between food deserts and obesity. And one of the key paragraphs in here that really struck me was, it is unclear how the idea took hold that poor urban neighborhoods were food deserts, but it had immediate appeal. There is even an agricultural department food desert locator and a national food desert awareness month sponsored by the National Center of Public Research, a charitable foundation. How do you guys respond to that? I mean, the basis of a lot of the programs in Green Market, including the Double Up Your Food Bucks kind of stuff, are all based on the premise that food deserts exist in poor urban communities. So who's right here?
Do you want me to?
Michael, you start.
Michael, maybe you could go and just sort of talk about your strategies at Green Market.
Let me say a few things. First of all, I can write a book that says that, let me not go there because I don't know who's listening on the other end and might interpret what I say the wrong way. Yeah, I can design a study that's going to say anything. And I can have a Harvard degree, and I can have a Yale degree, and I can back it up with lots of figures and statements, and it still might not be right. I want to know who's publishing it, what's behind it, and what's the point. And I also think that life is not black and white. We live in a very gray world. And we often like to oversimplify things and say that we've created the magic solution to this newly identified issue. But I will get into specifics, because it is a mission of Green Market and Grow NYC, who a program, you know, the nonprofit that Green Market is a part of, to ensure that all New Yorkers have access to the healthiest, freshest, regionally produced products. And we have spent years, whether through the Learn It, Grow It, Eat It program, really having farmers. I mean, we had farmers markets in Washington Heights and in the South Bronx long before the term food desert was ever coined. And we knew 25 years ago that every neighborhood wants healthy food for their families, wants the ability to access it, and wants to have their families eating healthy food. Doesn't matter what your income level is or where you're from. We have markets that thrive in low-income communities. We have markets that fail in very wealthy communities. And it's really about community support and community buy-in and other options. I started working in the field of sustainable agriculture in Red Hook, Brooklyn. And when I started, I did not know what those words meant. I was not into farming. I did not know about food desert issues. Food desert was not a term yet. But what I did know is that 40% of household incomes were less than $10,000. The median household income was at $14,000. And that the neighborhood had disproportionate rates of diet-related illnesses. And that the food that was available to them, there was a supermarket, a C-Town. And there was a 99-cent store that sold other products. This was before Fairway went in. And I know that the C-Town meat was irradiated, if not bleached. I knew that when I would shop there, I would not want to buy any of the produce that was available. The varieties were, there may have been iceberg lettuce, there may have been Red Delicious apples, and there may have been Granny Smiths, and they were bruised, and they were waxed, and they had been sitting there for a long time. And it wasn't anything that I was certainly going to buy. And I knew what my kids were eating, which was what you could get for a dollar. They got two small juices and two honey buns, really cheap calories. So, yeah, I mean, this study and this newspaper article that we're reading where it says, we might be surprised to learn that there are more fast food and corner stores in lower-income communities. No, we're not surprised to learn. That's what our community has been saying for decades. And that cheap calories does not necessarily mean health. There is a relationship between cheap calories and lack of health. And I could cite numerous studies that directly contradict Dr. Lee's assertion that say there are more supermarkets prevalent in lower-income communities than they are in upper and middle-income. I mean, all the studies that I've ever quoted are that there are a third to half as many supermarkets in lower-income communities and in middle- and upper-income communities. So, I think you have to look at the methodology and what have you. But there are also other issues at play. And if I start rambling, cut me off. If I'm rambling, cut me off at any time. But, you know, well, they say there's a supermarket within 1 to 2 miles of every urban community.
So how do you get there?
How do you get there?
And how do you lug your groceries back? Actually, what was most interesting to me was not so much the article, but the comments that it generated, of which I read, you know, at least a couple of dozen. I don't know if you guys did that too, but, you know, below they have the comment opportunities. And, you know, they brought up exactly the issues that, you know, you just brought up with transportation issues. And then there's the whole issue of cooking. Who's going to cook it? You know, like, I mean... There's such a lack of education around nutrition, around basic cooking skills, around how people get their food and get it to their house and who's going to prepare it once it gets there and all that jazz. I mean, there's so much more to why people eat fast food than just whether or not they have access. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back on Straight No Chaser with Michael Hurwitz and Stacey Miller.
program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries. They cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information. And be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Okay, we are back. Sorry about that, folks. A little, shall we say, engineering malfunction there. Stacy Miller, Executive Director of the Farmers Market Coalition, and Michael Hurwitz, from Executive Director of Green Market NYC. Thanks for hanging in there, you guys. So, Stacy, you were going to comment quickly on the article that Gina Colata wrote about food deserts and obesity, and then let's move on to what the farmers market sort of really is.
Sure, and I don't know how much more Michael got to say after he...
I already cut him off. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, right after he said that. The phone got on me. So I think this article brings up like three thoughts, you know, and I think Michael and I should probably write a book together because I'm like going to ramble about this issue too. But I think, first of all, the idea of defining a food desert by the availability of a grocery store is pretty antiquated, not very creative way of, you know, that exemplifies this tendency that we have to address a very complex problem that's led to by like physical, economic, cultural issues with a very singularly focused solution. Mm-hmm. The grocery stores, of course, they're being incentivized, are typically chains. Their economic contribution to the community is probably limited to low-wage jobs where the profits are, to a large extent, funneled off to distant headquarters. And I think it's an irony that the flagship grant program at USDA, the Farmers Market Promotion Program, that's designed to help support farmers markets, prioritizes projects that serve food deserts. Meanwhile, the very definition of a food desert will not change. You could put five farmers markets and really transform the accessibility to good quality food in a community, and yet you'd still technically be considered a food desert. Mm-hmm. Under that current definition. So I think, though the issue of food equity is very, very real, as Michael pointed out, I think that we need to be a little bit more creative in thinking about the solutions. The second point I wanted to make is that the myth, of course, is that were pointed out by many of the commenters to that article in the New York Times, was that grocery stores are somehow this gleaming beacon of healthy choices, right? You know, we look at the retail space in any grocery store, and it processed foods and beverages typically predominate. As John Weidman from the Food Trust said in that article, and not all grocery stores are created equal.
Right.
And then again, you know, that doesn't mean that the food environment and access is not absolutely critical. But the notion that like if you build it, they will come, I think itself, in some ways is naive. That's not the only part of the equation. I mean, if you go back in time to 2006, when the Farmers Market Promotion Program that I just referred to was founded, I found some data that you know that year was $1 million in grants for farmers markets in that first year of the grant program, mm-hmm. which sounds like quite a bit of money. But that same year, McDonald's spent $850 million just on its traditional media advertising in the U.S. And the company that owns KFC, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, spent $76 million over the past 10 years just on Super Bowl ads.
Oh, man.
Pepsi
nice
and
stats,
Coke spent
Stacey.
Nearly $10 million together on lobbying last year. Mars, you know, maker of many a candy bar that mm-hmm. we may have grown up to love, spent $2.3 million last year just in lobbying Congress.
Wow.
So until the price tag of processed foods represents the true cost, then we're really still at the early stages, I think, of fighting for health and equity in our communities, or what we come to refer to as food deserts.
Excellent. Thanks very much for those stats, Stacey. That was super.
It's brilliant. I mean, and I just want to chime in that subsidies and advertising are our two greatest competitors. And I always say that my advertising budget is less than the cost of a song in one of those McDonald's commercials. And that's what we're up against. And they also have lobbyists, and they also have they fund research studies. So it's that really is our greatest competition, and it can be very overwhelming at times.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on and talk about what you're really here to talk about, because we've blown off almost half the program talking about this. Farmers markets have expanded enormously in the last two decades. I think I read a statistic that said we've gone in the last, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 years from 1,700 nationwide to over 7,000. So let's start with Michael, address, you know, the impact this has on rural life and agriculture. Is this, you know, is this really giving the shot in the arm to small-scale ag that we're hoping for, or is it just kind of a drop in the bucket?
Well, from the national explosion, I think Stacy can address better, but I can certainly speak to what I've seen in the last 10 years here, and having, you know, green market's been around for 35 years. And I, you know, what was happening the 15 years prior to its being founded is the same thing that we're seeing today, and that was the loss of 500,000 acres of farmland just in the Hudson Valley alone. So what's happening? Yeah, I mean, I think that more and more farmers are realizing that the industrial system is not working for them, and particularly small farmers, and that their reliance on getting a larger return of the food dollar is what's going to keep their farms in business. And I'd say about 90% of our farmers would not have their farms in production if they didn't have the ability to sell directly to consumers. Mm-hmm. In the last 5 years, we've gone from 170 producers to over 235. You know, we have 53 market locations, and it absolutely is because more and more farmers and more rural communities realize that their survival depends on being able to have access directly to the consumer. Right. And more consumers are beginning to understand the relationship between food and health, whether it's personal health, community health, or environmental health, and want to have that connection with their food and want to know where their food comes from. And there's nothing that's more transparent and traceable than direct marketing.
Yeah, absolutely. And Stacey, when you look at the sort of the national picture, do you see farmers markets growing into communities that you wouldn't have expected? Like, I mean, Michael, it's kind of a given that the Northeast and certainly New York City area is going to be very open and receptive. But Stacey, right, do you see in smaller towns in the Midwest and so on, where sort of that message isn't maybe as in your face as it is here? Do you see the growth of farmers markets in those communities as well?
When you look at the evolution of farmers markets over the last 10 years, and the USDA Farmers Market Directory is a good at least estimate of that trend, you know, there's been 150% growth in the number of farmers markets according to their records over the last 10 years. And I think what you'll see, you know, where there might be a stereotype of like high density of farmers markets on both the West Coast and the East Coast, over that 10-year period, you start seeing a lot of filling in the Midwest. A lot of we have members in 48 states, and I'm often surprised at the types of markets or the types of organizations that are organizing markets, and I think it's really encouraging that markets can be run by municipalities, by community health organizations, by hospitals, by agricultural organizations, by environmental organizations, sustainable ag organizations. And I think that's a real strength to the movement, is that the diversity of missions and values that we all bring to the sector. But Michael's right, like between the last two ag censuses, there's been more than 4 million acres of U.S. farmland that's been developed. So, you know, the trend of younger people getting into farming, which farmers markets I think is really enabled and empowered, I don't know that we're necessarily keeping pace with how many farmers are being lost. I mean, we're certainly kind of making a dent in that and really inspiring a new generation. But as more and more consumers get involved, I mean, we're going to continue to have to push that envelope. One of the things that I think is really interesting and actually has inspired me about Michael's markets is that, you know, 10 years ago, you might not have seen anybody outside the Midwest trying to produce and market grains locally or hops locally or certain kinds of tree fruits or vegetables that look familiar to the many new waves of immigrants that we see here in the U.S. Mm. And because farmers markets offer a venue that incentivizes innovation and those that have policies in place that put farmers first, you kind of create this vacuum where suddenly you have entrepreneurs trying to fill a niche to produce those products locally because they know that they have a market in which they can innovate and experiment on a small scale, which no other part of the food system allows them to do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really interesting point, Stacey. I mean, I love the idea that these people are starting to cater to immigrant populations and create, you know, opportunities where they're or grow crops that would not necessarily have been, you know, recognizable to the overall population. But thanks to an immigrant group coming in and people recognizing that they're going for it. That makes it a more sort of viable, vibrant market, too, doesn't it? And it makes more people aware of those crops that they might not necessarily have used in the past.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of cool to see those cultural bridges being built in a farmer's market where I know one producer who was growing sweet potato greens for some of his fellow African residents in the community where the market was. And that begs a lot of questions. People coming by, what is that? So then you're creating this opportunity to educate people and really open their minds that farmers markets are not just tomatoes and green beans and sweet corn.
And from the social perspective, you're having neighbors talking to each other and uniting around food.
Yeah.
And having conversations that they might not otherwise have, and certainly that don't take place in a supermarket.
Exactly. You guys, that makes me want to jump right to this question that I had for you about whether or not farmers markets can be scaled to the point where they could manage institutional contracts. Because I think that, you know, Michael, you and I have talked in the past about whether or not regional farmers can be integrated into procurement contracts for the school lunch program in New York City.
Right.
And so let's talk a little bit about how, you know, if farmers markets are becoming a more vibrant and thriving commercial operation, how likely is it for those farms to be able to come together and have a farmers market act as kind of a clearinghouse, or would a farmers market act as a clearinghouse for institutional contracts? Michael, why don't you start and then Stacey after?
Sure. I'll answer this question in a couple of ways, and that is I often say when talking about the need for wholesale infrastructure in the city is that farmers markets are amazing for what they do, but they can't address everything, and they can't address all of the demand, particularly in our region, with an emphasis on the institutional buyers. Mm-hmm. You know, institutional buyers are really trying to pay as little as they possibly can. There are some that who are then able to pass their costs on or figure out other ways to pay for those resources, but for the most part, like the Department of Education, they are trying to enter into the lowest paying contract for the food that they can. They don't have a lot of money for reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So the answer is yes and no. There is a significant amount of wholesale business that happens at a farmer's market. And a market like Union Square, I mean, we have, even in the South Bronx, we have food pantries coming to pick up from John Schmidt and probably Gary Globuchowski, a couple of the farmers who are there. So I think on a certain scale, absolutely, if there are farmers at a farmer's market who have a wholesale component to their businesses, absolutely. But there are mid-sized growers, and we're losing our mid-sized growers at an even more alarming rate than our smallest guys.
Hmm.
And they are wholesale growers, and they want to sell by the case or the pallet, not by a tractor trailer load or by a bunch. And they are the solution to a lot of these issues that we're talking about and about institutional procurement of regionally produced agriculture products. But there is no infrastructure for them in the city and not much upstate for them to be able to aggregate those products and have the supply that can meet that price point. But the answer is yes, it's possible. And farmers markets can serve as mini hubs. And obviously, those that have infrastructure can probably have our position to do a better job. But every day you'll see a significant amount of wholesale going on at Union Square, Brooklyn Borough Hall, and some of the other farmers markets that we have. Mm-hmm.
Stacy, what about nationwide? Do you see an opportunity for farmers markets to be involved in institutional contracts in, say, smaller towns or cities?
I like the way Michael put that, yes and no, because I think that's true. I do see farmers markets as the ultimate food hub, and many of them have sort of organically or informally filled that role of kind of creating relationships, building relationships, or allowing farmers to build relationships with chefs, with other community buyers, with creating the demand in the community for parents, for restaurant patrons to want to request or demand certain local products in those other outlets. So in that way, farmers markets do play that role. But I don't think they have to be the ones that formalize that kind of a infrastructure because, again, as Michael said, you know, farmers markets have a lot to do what they're doing well. And I think the markets that really do well are ones that focus on the farmers market itself as an organism, mm-hmm. and then help build partnerships or sort of facilitate or pollinate new entrepreneurs to kind of start that process. I know here in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live, there's a pretty well-known nonprofit called the Local Food Hub, and they have completely independent from the farmers market, but kind of inspired by it in some ways, and using the relationships that they made with all the producers at the farmers market to create their own business model where they do aggregate and distribute to a wide variety of retailers, institutions, restaurants in the region. And so I think it's really inspiring when that happens, and I think farmers markets should certainly sort of support those efforts, but they don't need to be the ones undertaking them. Mm-hmm. If most farmers markets are, or 60% of farmers markets are run by volunteers, how they can take that on and do it well and do it professionally is a challenge. And there's certainly, and there's no doubt that there's a need for that kind of a resource, and it should be done well, just as farmers markets should be managed professionally.
Right, absolutely. Unfortunately, we have to wrap it up, you guys, I regret to say, because I had like 25 more questions for you both. But Stacy, why don't you tell people how they can get more information about the Farmers Market Coalition and, you know, stay up to date on what you guys are doing. And also, if they need a resource for information or support, you're a great place to go. So what's your website?
Great. It's farmersmarketcoalition.org, all smushed together into one word. And we do have a Farmers Market resource library there where you can search for existing tools, resources, example documents, and we're always kind of compiling new resources and putting together webinars and other kinds of tools for our members. We're kind of really active in some of the analyzing the Farm Bill as that's being developed. The Senate just released its draft late on Friday, and so we're kind of working on those kinds of issues. We're about to launch, actually, our second annual campaign this year to celebrate our sixth anniversary, cool. Which is June 6th. So if you go to our website, you can find out all about that and ways to support us or learn more or become a member.
Sounds great. And Michael, you're just grownyc.org, right?
We are. And I encourage people to go check out our compost expansion and find out where they can now take residential food scraps that's being collected by the New York City Department of Sanitation. For the first time since 1992, DSNY is actually piloting a residential food waste pickup at farmers markets.
Wow, that's way cool. I didn't know
that.
It is
amazing.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, composting is certainly the wave of the future, and we will be back next week. Thank you both very much. Michael Hurwitz from the Green Market and Stacy Miller from Farmers Market Coalition. We'll be talking again soon. Michael, I'll see you soon. And next week, folks, I hope you'll tune in for a discussion about urban farming around the world. We'll be talking with an author who discusses that in her new book, Farm City. So see you next week, folks. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks to my sponsor, Fairway. Until next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.